Chapter 2. The Ultimate Love Affair. The greatest good anyone can do for humanity begins with a dynamic encounter with the living God. I refer to a spiritual transformation so revolutionary that it's aptly termed being born again, though overuse has sapped this term of its power. You could walk down church aisles all of your life without ever marrying. Everyone knows that. Yet, tragically, countless thousands have walked down a church aisle and falsely assumed that this made them born again. Like marriage, it is a relationship, not a ritual, that counts. Spiritual rebirth results from a life-changing union between two persons. You can mumble the sinner's prayer, the saint's prayer, any prayer you like. You can join the best church, get wet, slurp communion, look more godly than an archangel, and have not a throb of spiritual life. Your act can be so convincing that you even fool yourself and remain unaware that your life has missed an entire dimension. In style and content, this chapter is quite different from the rest of the book. So if you are certain you enjoy daily intimacy with God, you may prefer to go straight to the heart of the book by skipping this chapter and return here later. I don't want you losing interest by dwelling on matters you're already familiar with. For the rest of us, however, this chapter is essential. The remainder of the book will help only if you put this chapter to work. The quest for fulfillment starts here. Dare to dream. We crave love. It is an essential ingredient of a meaningful life. Yet it is a risky, potentially agonizing experience. Death or disagreement can so easily rob us of the one we love. Though we kiss with our eyes closed, relationships are frighteningly fragile. Beauty sags. People change. The deeper our love, the deeper our insecurity. Reality is cold, but dreams are too hot to hold. Our passions seem so insatiable that we shrink from them, yet still they haunt us. Just for a moment, release the iron grip that keeps your longings suppressed in the dungeons of your mind. Let your longings waft free before your gaze, no matter how unattainable they seem. Dare to see what they reveal. You burn for unwaning intimacy, a companion who will never fail you, a carer who will always be there, no matter what the circumstance or hour, someone whose love never ceases to astound you, someone whose charms and beauties and powers will not fade with the passing years. Too often you are misunderstood. You crave a friend who can slip inside your mind. Ideally, someone who has not only heard of your every trauma and triumph from birth, but experienced them with you. You need to unburden yourself with a confidant who knows your blackest secrets, yet delights in you with unswerving devotion. When life's blows send you reeling, you ache for an admirer who not only passionately longs to meet your deepest needs, but is always able to. You need a partner so capable that when crisis swallows crisis, you can trust your friend to comfort, protect, and power you to success. On the contrary, you want someone who will nerve you to reach the heights you were born for. You pine for someone changeless, yet exciting, someone who fits your needs so exactly that it feels you were made for each other, someone you will be forever proud of, someone whose love for you is so vast it always satisfies, someone faithful and genuine, open and warm, yet so resistant to the ravages of aging, sickness, and tragedy as to seem immortal. Well, no human fits the bill, yet the craving remains. A few dreamers keep chasing the elusive high of starry-eyed love, forever groping for the perfect relationship. But most of us give up. A person would have to be God to meet our criteria. And how could he help? We're flesh and blood. God, if he exists, is some nebulous, unapproachable spirit. The notion of a friendship with God is preposterous. Or is it? Within the realms of the unknown, almost anything could dwell, even a God poised to shatter our insensibility to him. If there really is intelligence behind creation, why were we made with cravings that could never be satisfied? Is God a sadist? Or were those yearnings for the ideal companion planted within us because he longs to fulfill them by being your closest friend? Could it be that God seems impersonal only because you are not on close terms with him? If God were impersonal, that would make us superior to our Creator. That's absurd. If we can speak, feel, and love, our Maker can do all of that and more. God is warm. This exciting person, whose never-ending companionship and limitless power are able to fill the unfillable hole within us, is the perfect partner we ache for. Yet this very perfection makes him unapproachable. The Almighty is awesomely holy, incomparably virtuous. We are not. We come hurtling back to reality. Life's a bed of roses. The beauty is enticing and the aroma alluring, but the thorns are cruel. There's a solution, but to appreciate the grandeur of that solution, we must dwell for a couple of pages on the magnitude of the problem. This is so distasteful that we instinctively recoil from it, longing to deny its existence. Our reaction proves the truth of Jesus' assertion that people love darkness, that is, ignorance and wrongdoing, rather than light, which is truth and purity. We'll expose facts that challenge the limits of our ability to grapple with reality, yet facing them is the most liberating experience a human can know. Let me illustrate. I'm stumbling up a perilous trail, far from civilization. Angry blisters jostle on the pain scale with bruises and open wounds. The blazing sun sucks my throat and mocks my exhausted supplies. If I don't get there soon, panic rips down my spine, gets trapped in my stomach, and thrashes in wide-eyed terror. I stagger on, virtually insensible to the weird sound overhead. The trail twists, and to my amazed surprise, a helicopter stands before me. A pilot approaches, claims to be part of a search party, and tells me I've been trampling for days in the wrong direction. "Do you take me for an idiot?" I fume. "My bush skills..." Patiently, he takes out a map and dismantles my every argument. My spirit wilts. I could never survive the distance to even the nearest waterhole. Then the pilot offers to fly me to the exquisite oasis I had been looking for. My worries vaporize. The sooner I admit my need of help, the quicker I can get out of here. In such circumstances, even I can handle being told that I'm wrong. Now magnify that tale and transfer it from fantasy to reality, and you glimpse what this chapter is about. Discovering we are wrong can be the most thrilling moment of our lives. Confronting the truth of the next few paragraphs can usher you into a new world of joyous freedom, fulfillment, and challenge, and excitement. When Frederick the Great visited Potsdam Prison, every convict he spoke to professed innocence. Finally, he encountered a thief under the sentence of death. "Your Majesty," he said, "I am guilty and richly deserving of punishment." "Release this scoundrel," commanded the king, "before he corrupts all the noble, innocent people here." A similar surprise awaits everyone who dares admit the truth. I make no claim to powers of mind and pen sufficient to portray the wonder and majesty of the world's greatest love story. Nor can I highlight each facet of the unassailable wisdom, justice, and moral perceptions that open the possibility of a transformation of human nature so radical that it defies comprehension. My hope is to whisk you into its benefits, not expound its intricacies. So if any of the following seems unconvincing, limitations of space and skill may be the problem. I warn, however, that in these critical issues, the real cause of blind spots usually turns out to be psychological or spiritual. The door to spiritual understanding is not human explanation, but supernatural enlightenment, divine revelation. And that door swings not on mind games, but on a willingness to surrender our stubborn will to the one who knows better than us. Already our defenses are on red alert. I ask you to face this issue because it leads not to shame, but to the exhilaration of a cleansed conscience. it leads not to oppressive restrictions, but to utter freedom. If we burst into a hospital and chanced upon a doctor sterilized for surgery, he could not touch us. We may seem immaculate, but not by his standards. We are like that in the presence of the Holy Lord. We may be as good as the next guy, but by the unassailable perfection of his holy standards, we are moral lepers. God must keep his distance. Now that seems an overreaction. But being surrounded by imperfection all of our lives has jaded our ability to see ourselves objectively. Deep down, we suspect the worst, but we flee from it like people refusing cancer checks, even though early diagnosis brings life, not death. A favorite, rarely conscious technique to silence our suppressed but nagging conscience is to concoct a doctored moral code that lets us entertain the delusion that we are morally superior to some people. What drives us to despise certain people or to gossip is not unkindness or snobbishness so much as a desperate attempt to drown the shrieks of our own conscience. We feel less guilt if we can convince ourselves that there are others who are morally worse. Our self-deception is so individual that I am unlikely to guess the reader's blind spot, let alone find my own. The following are just three countless possibilities. 1. A man might detest wife bashers while he cheats on his own wife, thus loading her dice in the deadly AIDS game. He toys, not with the possibility of injuring her, but with the possibility of killing her. He does this not to her face, but in cowardly deceit, and he is certain he soars at moral height far above anyone who would slap a woman. 2. We might label rape a hideous crime, but call the seduction of a married person love. Seduction ravishes its victims at the deepest level, debauching them so completely as to make them willing partners in immorality. Even the grave offense of rape leaves its unconsenting victims morally chaste. 3. We might feel superior to criminals when what differentiates us is not morality, but cowardice, fear of getting caught, or incurring the disapproval of others, etc., or lack of the opportunity, not knowing how to commit the perfect crime, or not holding a gun at our weakest moment. Each of us are infected by one of hypocrisy's innumerable strains, and the most dangerously afflicted are those oblivious to it. That's why Jesus said blatant sinners are more likely to find God than are the self-righteous. We are driven to all lengths, even to accusing God of injustice, to try to ease our guilt. We spurn God's laws, and then have the audacity to blame God. Why do the innocent suffer? We sneer, conveniently forgetting that anger, greed, and lies have hurt the innocent. For some suspicious reason, there is a degree of hurt we deem excusable, and the hurt we have inflicted happens to compare favorably with the standard we have arbitrarily set. With every atom of pride within me shrieking in protest, I am forced to the shattering conclusion that the moral gap between a sadistic murderer and myself is invisible, relative to the yawning chasm separating me from the flawless virtue of the Almighty God. The Holy One loathes our evil, but if he enslaved the human will, squelching evil by forcibly preventing all of us from indulging in pet sins, we'd be the first to shake our fists. If God is a God of love, why does he allow the evil that is rampant in this world? For anyone not entranced by his or her own double standards, the reason is obvious. God longs to destroy all evil, and the time is fast approaching when he will. But how, without unprincipled faith, could he do this without destroying you and me? I warned this horror story would take you to the edge of your tolerance. Rich rewards, however, await those with the courage to face facts we inwardly know to be true. When approaching a God who can make us more beautiful than we dare dream, no need to act like Burns patients smashing mirrors. Should we reform and never so much as think another wrong thought? It wouldn't help. If water is contaminated, pure water doesn't help. The water is still contaminated. There's a corruption in our past, and we cannot change the past. Some things God cannot do without violating his integrity. In court, found guilty of dangerous driving. The judge happens to be a close friend of the defendant. The judge to declare his guilty friend innocent. The offender less because he was his friend. Only a corrupt judge or display favoritism. Our God is our judge. Such monstrosity as a self-made person. None of us decided to come into or can even design our offsprings. From the brain cells we think with. We have everything. The Lord is maker and therefore owner of every modern organism we have ever used or abused. Like it or loathe it, makes us accountable to God for our selfishness. Our selfishness has hurt people. We prayed for the Supreme Judge to ignore our offenses. We follow at God when we see wrongdoing go unpunished. Though his devotion to you defies, he cannot do other than declare you guilty. Justice demands the penalty paid. There's two alternatives. Either someone pays it for you. It would be sheer conceit for me to consider the punishment. I have wickedness to answer for. But the Son of God, 2,000 years ago, the celestial judgment seat came to earth. The sole human who has lived a perfect life. In the purity, our highest moral achievements look like mud. So when Christ endured the pain and shame of a criminal's death, something of cataclysmic significance was happening. The timeless Son, the full blame for your sin. Physical torment soaked in a sea of spiritual agony. On the cross, a person who enjoyed eternal oneness with God. My God, why have you forsaken me? God was compelled to desert his son, treating him as the vilest sinner, until the horrific penalty was paid in full. After absorbing the full consequences of our depravity, Christ broke, blasting a path for us to follow. The focal point of this heart-stopping love, the greatest love, our response. Christ has provided a legal way, though guilty, can go scot-free. That does not make forgiveness automatic. To be intimate with the Lord of the galaxies, to have the divine power through your veins, to reach the people you are made for, requires a response on your part. Explain, let's return to the reckless driver. He would have to fine his friend for breaking the law. It is to offer a friend money to pay the fine. The offender, whether he accepts the judge's gift or not. It will break Jesus' heart if you slight his offer to suffer. The only alternative is for you to bear the penalty. That's the last thing he wants. God is anxious to save you from the hell and grant you a life. Let the partnership, but you must accept the gift. This involves saying that you need the gift. Sacrifice can absolve. There is one more consideration. By our lead-footed friends perpetuating offenses, he is a danger to the community. It would be wrong who plans to continue flouting the law. Similarly, it would be wrong forgive us until our attitude of sin has changed. A thought of the hordes who have tragically missed. A second analogy will confirm to you. You are trapped in a sea of sin. Bottomless watering cliffs. No one can tread water forever. The murky depths terrify you, except for one spot. You have found a place where deadly waters and the sensual waves are exquisite. How can anyone take seriously help if you're splashing around enjoying yourself? And what's the point of saving someone on plunging back after every rescue attempt? Sin can be saved. To initiate a sinless life and employ forgiveness. We're in sin's debt. Only Jesus can break it. But do you want him to? Want to be rid forever of your favorite sin? The Almighty gives us affecting our wishes. If we want him to be our God, he is in total control of our lives. It grieves and appalls him. In gentleness, he will permit us to go our own way. Of rejected love, God. You can never be forced to love someone, nor can you be forced to desire your heart. God has done all he can. It's over to you. To ignore our Creator is the height of He is the source of every good thing enjoyed. Even sin's fizzle of pleasure, that slippery shadow of the real thing seized while with him, is possible given ability to experience pleasure. The wonderful thing we take for granted comes from him. He even holds our atoms together, protects and nurtures even those who ignore him, providing abundant opportunity for them to respond to his astounding love. They don't want God to interfere. He does anyhow. Shower with a myriad of soft, warm, beautiful, refreshing, thrilling, inspiring gifts. At death, those who honor are finally granted their wish. That's the ultimate horror. Severed from the source of all love, beauty, fulfillment is a prospect too terrifying to contemplate. With a repentant attitude towards ungodly pleasures, however, and a reliance upon the pardoning power of Jesus' sacrifice, God free rein to do what he longs to do. Pay your debt to justice, to your account, the moral perfection of Christ. That makes you so wise that you need no longer be isolated from him. Then commence the conflict. What God desires is like a marriage. He wants lifelong devotion, not a superficial fling. Believing in the opposite sex does not make one married. Making a creed give us the right to live with God. True marriage involves commitment of all that you have and all that you are. It is believing in someone so completely trust your entire being to that person for life. Lord is eager to be that devoted to you. Urge to work, the commitment must be mutual. If a street kid, she would get his riches and he would get her debts. Tarred by her shame, she would gain his honor. For this to happen, she must turn from her rival relationships and bind herself and her meager possessions to this in marriage. Everything he has would become hers, she lets everything of hers become his. Similarly, if we entrust God everything we have, our abilities, our relationships and possessions, he is gracing us with divine extravagance. And our depravity relinquished sin. That's what killed him. In return, Jesus' sinless perfection envelops us to be on intimate terms with the Holy God. The culmination of this divine exchange of holiness for depravity will be seen when all evil is finally wiped off the planet. We will be saved, and no one can accuse God of injustice, borne the penalty himself. In entering this love pact, we give God the right to do whatever he likes with our assets. But the owner of the universe makes his riches available to us. We trade our talents for his omnipotence, our attempts to run our lives for his unlimited wisdom. We give him our time on earth, and he gives us eternity. In every way, we benefit from this proposal, and God gets the raw end. But God is love. He wants this holy union more than we can imagine. Don't break his heart by holding back. The following prayer corresponds to wedding vows in which you promise to love, honor, and obey the Lord, thus making him your God. In turn, the King of Kings makes you worthy of spiritual fusion with him and pledges to devote himself unreservedly to you. If the following accurately describes your feelings, you can make it your prayer by saying it aloud to God. Wonderful Lord, it hurts to admit how bad I've been. I've caused you grief, yet you sent your Son. He gave his life and defeated death to secure my pardon. You have given yourself totally for me, and I long to reciprocate. I respond to your overwhelming love by dedicating all I have to loving you. I yield to your loving protection and guidance. I surrender my sins to you, renouncing even those things that entice me. And in exchange, I receive your pardon and purity and your empowerment to live a life worthy of you. Thank you that we have now commenced a union that not even death can break. The Lord of heaven and earth knows your secret thoughts. If you've prayed the entire prayer honestly, you've entered a new spiritual realm. That's hard to believe. Everything seems the same, but not from heaven's perspective. The spiritual contract is sealed. The proof lies not in your feelings, such as whether you feel guilty or happy, but in the integrity of the Holy One. He has given His word in the Bible that whoever turns from sin and looks to Jesus for cleansing has a radically new destiny. God is no liar. If this is the first time you've genuinely offered such a prayer, you must be bursting with questions. Unfortunately, space forbids extending this outline into something that anticipates your every question. To overcome this shortcoming, I have written a book especially for you. Please write requesting a copy. If this proves inadequate, I invite you to put your queries directly to me in writing. Since there is nothing more important than spiritual rebirth, all letters of this vital matter will be answered, though I may not be able to give this guarantee for other correspondents. Wind-up. You've had enough empty living. At last you are free to soar above a mundane existence to uncharted heights of excellence. You have commenced